As I was saying earlier, muddled thinking on the Middle Ages is our final story. And one of the things we're muddled about is our use of the word medieval. It's, of course, become very pejorative, a term of abuse that we can direct at the thought processes such as they are of, Donald Trump. It makes historians like Matthew Gabriel incredibly annoyed. And so last week in the Washington Post, Matthew wrote an article called Five Myths About the Middle Ages. And it's just the most fascinating piece of work. I'll just read the opening lines because they show that Matthew's concern isn't just a mere academic exercise. He wrote, "Most Americans get their ideas about the Middle Ages from popular culture like Game of Thrones or from the inevitable rigmarole after a politician refers to a crusade. In other words, it's all dragons and dastardly politics and religious-inspired violence. Yet the European Middle Ages, a period spanning more than 1,000 years, was much richer and weirder than even some of the best fiction or political spin." Matthew is professor of medieval studies at Virginia Tech, and he joins us via Skype. Welcome to our little wireless program.
Oh, thank you very much. It's my pleasure to be here.
Matthew, you've said in other interviews that one of the reasons the Middle Ages is misused is because, and I think this is an interesting argument, because it's used as a blank space to project our fears about our time.
Yeah, indeed. And I think it has a lot to do with the contemporary characterization of it as the Dark Ages as well. It seems to be a period that the modern world has moved beyond. And so it's a way of kind of putting on these characteristics of humanity that we don't really like anymore, that maybe we recognize in ourselves but want to think that we've moved beyond. And it just becomes this kind of bucket that we can put those problems, if you will, into that space.
Well, let's wander through some of your myths. One of the subjects you've written about, or you've written books about, is the First Crusade and those conflicts which people see as a fight to the death between Christianity and Islam. Myth number one, please.
Sure, yeah. So the myth number one in my article in the Washington Post was that Christianity and Islam were constantly in conflict. And what I tried to do there, obviously in a very short space, was to demonstrate really how complicated the relationship between what we think of as these kind of monolithic entities, Christianity and Islam, how complicated the relationship really was. Like, even during the First Crusade, when Pope Urban II in 1095 called for these Christian warriors to go to the East and reclaim Jerusalem for Christianity, take it back from the Muslims, even along the way, the Crusaders were more than happy to make alliances with various Islamic city-states against other Islamic city-states. They seemed to recognize a lot of the political infighting that was going on in the Middle East.
I hadn't realized, for example, the Christian kings would hire Muslim mercenaries against their Christian rivals.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. So, people in the Middle Ages, just like really people in any period, were fundamentally pragmatic. And if they could use something to their advantage against a common enemy, even if it were short term, then they were absolutely more than happy to do that.
And as late as the 16th century, France had no problem making an alliance with the Ottoman Empire.
Absolutely not. During the wars of religion in what we think of as the early modern period or the Renaissance or Reformation, France thought that the Holy Roman Empire was a bigger enemy, their fellow Catholics, and so they had no problem allying with the Ottoman Turks to fight against the Holy Roman Empire.
So who do we blame for these distortions about myth one? Academics, Christian fundamentalists, IS?
It's a little bit of everything, unfortunately. A lot of it has to do with kind of the roots of historiography and kind of meaning that the way that history was practiced, not just within the academy, but within kind of more popular conceptions during the 19th and 20th centuries, as people were thinking about European empire in a more modern sense, they started to look back for predecessors, and they found those in a lot of cases in the Middle Ages. And so what Britain, what France, what Belgium, what Germany were doing in Africa, in the Middle East, in Asia. They thought that they were kind of recreating this Christian expansion, this European expansion, the civilizing process into the New World. That didn't have a lot to do with what the medievals themselves thought they were doing, but it seemed to make sense within that 19th and 20th century context.
I found myth number two, or your response to it, particularly beguiling, because this has come as a surprise to a lot of the listeners. In every film, television series, book about the Middle Ages, everyone seems to be a church. Mm-hmm. Thank God that's inaccurate.
No, absolutely not. So, and I think it's not only that people didn't defer to religious authority throughout the Middle Ages, and it was again a much more complicated relationship, but even in instances in which people were actually in church. I mean, I think we tend to think of church going as a common experience. For example, is that what we do or what modern people do when they go to a church is something that happened in the Middle Ages, and that's absolutely not the case. People took it as seriously as they might take it today, and that kind of varied. Sometimes you're not paying attention, and sometimes you are. but even in the texts that survive, we have plenty of instances and lots of evidence, even given kind of the spotty survival record of the records from the Middle Ages, of people making fun of the church, especially the clergy, the priests. That they recognize that not all the priests were really in it for the betterment of humanity or something like that.
What a shocking and blasphemous allegation to make, Matthew, particularly with your prenom. And let me just read you to the listener. People are people. They naturally had many interests, including sex, which people in the Middle Ages spent plenty of time thinking, writing, and joking about.
Indeed. So there's, especially in the 12th and 13th centuries and then beyond, we have lots of poems that were created by people outside of the church. And they wrote about things that people outside of the church often think about, meaning not formal priests would think about. Sexual relations, how to find a wife, how to find a husband, how to con a woman into having sex, stuff that's unfortunately a little bit too familiar even in today's modern world. One of the pieces that I referenced specifically is called a fabliau, a piece of what's thought to be, though with some problems with that, kind of peasant writing, in which this guy basically takes advantage of a priest who is lecherous and uses it to his advantage to make sure that he gets what he wants and the priest looks like a fool at the end of it.
As a lifelong atheist, I was delighted decades ago to come across some hieroglyphs in close proximity to the Great Pyramid, in which people involved in building the damn thing wrote, "Are the gods true?" Was there much of that sort of discussion in the Middle Ages? Was there, agnosticism? Was there faith?
I think it's hard to tell. I think part of the reason is, again, how spotty our evidence is, what survives. The vast majority of stuff that survives from the European Middle Ages is produced or at least connected in some way to formal religious houses, either produced by priests or monks or produced for those religious institutions. It's hard to see within that kind of issues of agnosticism or atheism.
But there is clear evidence of people thumbing their nose at aspects of religion they felt...
Right. Oh, absolutely, absolutely. The idea of critique is embedded within the Christian tradition, and you see that kind of all the way back to the very foundations. The Middle Ages is no different. In fact, with the expansion of education in the later Middle Ages, it really seems to pick up steam. Is that people seem to think that there's this vast majority of society that is not a formal member of the church. What happens to us? Why are you within the church kind of holding back access to God, when we can read the Bible as well as anybody else?
Well, that critique was a part of Christian culture, mm-hmm. Is there evidence of it within the Islamic faith?
Oh, absolutely as well. I think that's certainly throughout the Middle Ages in Islamic culture, like emanating from from vibrant intellectual centers like Baghdad or Alexandria, elsewhere in North Africa, Iberia, which the vast majority of Iberia was under Islamic control for much of the Middle Ages. The intellectual culture there like dwarfed what was going on in Europe through at least through the early Middle Ages. And so the discussions back and forth, high theology, down to kind of poetry, which was again kind of very similar to what I described about Europe, Christian Europe, critiquing kind of these theological points, like asking questions about like, well, why is this the way that it should be? It shouldn't be like that. What about the rest of us? We care about real things about this world. Like, why can't we participate in them? Why are they being denied to us?
My guest is myth-busting Matthew Gabriel, the author of this terrific piece in the Washington Post called Five Myths About the Middle East. Okay, myth number three may upset more people than the others. Europeans in the Middle Ages were clearly white and Christian.
Yes, this is one of the great kind of misconceptions, you know. And as I point out, the entree there, at least for the piece, was some criticism that's been leveled at the hugely popular Game of Thrones, asking why it seems so white. Why aren't there people of different races? And George R. R. Martin and kind of responded in a very widespread belief that everybody in Europe was white at that time. So he's being a little bit kind of, he's trying to create kind of a historical setting within his admittedly fantasy world. But what's really been interesting is the archaeological, textual, artistic research that's been going on for the last, you know, 50, 60 years has demonstrated that people in the Middle Ages and European Middle Ages thought about race a lot, and they lived next to people who were probably what we would think of as different races.
Well, it's Arabs odd that we did a program on Elizabethan times on Shakespeare, and once again, Elizabethan England had quite a lot of dark people around the place, and of course Shakespeare wrote about them from time to time.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And you see that, you know, I make reference, unfortunately I got the date wrong, that was my fault, but there's this famous statue of St. Maurice at Germany's Magdeburg Cathedral, which is from the 13th century, which is, he's dark-skinned. I mean, he's clearly represented as an African. There's in Wolfram von Eschenbach's famous poem Parzival, there's Feirefiez, who is literally half white and half black. He's portrayed as kind of a zebra striped in a way, but he's a hero within that text. Like, he's absolutely, you know, a good guy. The other thing too to think about, and we mentioned this earlier, is that like when France was making a treaty with the Ottoman Turks in the 16th century, the reason they were doing that is because they thought of the Ottoman Empire as part of Europe, as within that orbit. So everything that happened in what we think of as modern Turkey was part of their community, their intellectual world, and that involved people who looked very, very different than kind of a very standard kind of white person that we think of as inhabiting all of the Middle Ages.
So, beloved listeners, if you read Matthew's piece, you will learn that although nowhere near as diverse as your modern metropolis, medieval Europe pulsed with difference, racial and religious. And it's interesting, Matthew, that Jews and Christians lived together in most major cities.
Indeed, yeah. And I think that's kind of the other kind of vector of difference that's really important when we think of the European Middle Ages, and we kind of leave it to the side, is we think of Europe as very homogenous, and it really, really wasn't. There were indeed Jewish communities throughout many of the major cities, and people lived together relatively peacefully, though that's problematic in some other ways. Throughout most of the Middle Ages, it was really kind of in the later Middle Ages after the year 1000, and then especially later on, that people started to segregate themselves from one another. The Christians kind of forcing the Jews out from being amongst them. Also throughout Iberia, throughout what's now Spain and Portugal, I mean, Muslims, Christians, and Jews just lived together. There's a tradition talking about the Spanish Middle Ages to kind of try to separate kind of Spanish architecture, for example, from Christian architecture. But it's really difficult to do that because it's just Spanish architecture. That mosques look very, very similar to churches, which look very, very similar to synagogues. Yeah. People were living with one another, and you have lots of instances of, like we mentioned, Christian kings hiring Muslim mercenaries, but also Islamic kings hiring Jewish viziers, and Christian rulers hiring Jewish physicians, and Christians hiring Arabic physicians, Muslim physicians, and all sorts of stuff like that. That wasn't that big a deal until it very suddenly kind of became a big deal.
Okay, the last two myths you deal with are really about the idea that the Middle Ages wasn't a time of ignorance. They weren't the Dark Ages. And let's just take one thing here. Mm-hmm. The myth that people thought the earth was flat, and I'm glad you take this on because, as you say, it's a zombie myth.
It is indeed, yeah. Yeah, it just keeps kind of popping back up. It's interesting because it'll pop up in very unexpected places. In the article, I mentioned kind of an offhand comment by President Obama, and then the American pundit Glenn Beck, who talked about that. The other person, it's come up with is the physicist and kind of pop culture icon Neil deGrasse Tyson, who a while ago, I don't know if you remember, there was one of the hip-hop artists, B.O.B., mentioned something about the Earth actually, he thought the actual Earth was actually flat. Neil deGrasse Tyson kind of tweeted him, no, it's not, but there's no problem having kind of a medieval because you have a medieval worldview, I think he said that, you know, we can still enjoy your music. And then, you know, Neil deGrasse Tyson went on to say, you know, people in the Middle Ages had forgotten what the ancient Greeks and Romans had known, that the earth was indeed spherical. That's absolutely, absolutely not true. Everybody in the Middle Ages knew that the earth was a sphere. When we talk about Christopher Columbus, which is kind of the starting point for this this flat earth myth, the problem that Columbus had with Ferdinand and Isabella when he was setting out for what he thought to be the New World was how big the earth was. Everybody knew it was a sphere. He thought it was much shorter, much smaller, and so he thought he would get to Asia a lot quicker than he would have. Everybody else just thought, they didn't think he was going to fall off the end of the earth. They just thought it would take him forever and he would die in the middle of the ocean.
I suddenly recall there was someone involved with the Great Library in Alexandria who walked from one end of the Nile to the other, counting his steps, and calculated to a remarkable degree of accuracy the dimensions of the planet.
Yeah, no, absolutely. So, you know, the amount of knowledge about actually the size of the Earth was tremendously remarkable. I believe it was, I might get this wrong, and I apologize, I believe it was Ptolemy. He calculated the size of the Earth within, you know, just like 1% or 2% or something like that.
I mean, it was incredible. Not a bad effort, really.
No, not a bad effort, given the tools that he had available to him back in ancient Greece.
Well, as we wind up, let's look at the great myth, and that is, the worst of the myths, and that is that the Middle Ages were all violence, repression, and terror. Now, sure, you enumerate some of those problems, but you also point out that those years saw the creation of artistic marvels, the birth of the university, breakthroughs in the natural sciences and literature that still move the soul.
Yes, no, absolutely. So, you know, and I think that goes back to your initial question about the Middle Ages as a blank space. I think the Dark Ages is a convenient way of excusing the modern world for things that we know are going on. You know, as people have pointed out, the Dark Ages or the Middle Ages is conceived of as this period of kind of incessant violence that for 1,000 years people didn't study, they didn't know anything, they had lost all the knowledge of the Greeks and Romans, and they just kind of killed each other, often for religious reasons. Modernity certainly is no stranger to everything that was just discussed, is that we have a current of anti-intellectualism throughout the world in some cases. You know, we have religiously inspired violence all over the place. But at the same time, you know, we have in the Middle Ages created, you know, the great cathedrals of Europe, which are still standing, which are testaments to beauty.
Matthew, I've got to wind you up just as gaining momentum. Matthew Gabriel, Associate Professor and Coordinator of Medieval and Early Modern Studies in the Department of Religion and Culture at Virginia Tech.